For the week of September 4th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 379, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you, Michael? How is the South?
I'm great. It's Labor Day weekend, and of course, we did our tribute to Jerry Lewis last weekend. Because, okay, you know, he's known for his Labor Day telethons. He's been on the air for 2 days at a time. And we said, let's be on the air for 2 days at a time. And you said, no, 2 hours is plenty.
Okay, you're talking about our last show, which went a little over. And by a little, I mean a lot. And by a lot, I mean it was 2 hours.
That's right. So, and I felt like that was our tribute to Jerry Lewis, but nobody seemed to realize that. And mostly people said, what, you couldn't do another 4 minutes? I mean, it was an hour and 56 minutes. Like, you couldn't get to two?
Well, I cut time out. I was trying to get it under 2 hours.
Yeah, there you go. And of course, 2 hours, we make mistakes. I'm confused somehow by Taylor Swift. We're going to talk about her later in the show. But her lyric video set some sort of record in 24 hours. But that's not the official video. The lyric video hit 19 million in 24 hours. And that was some sort of record, according to Variety or whatever. But the official video hit 43.2 million views in 24 hours. I don't know whether they're adding them together. Well, they can't be because that's a 24-hour period. So, you know, we're confusing lyric and official video and all this. Who knows? They've got different metrics for every day of the week. You know, do they add all the Despacito videos together? I don't know.
And I can tell you, I was a little confused too. And I heard, oh, Taylor Swift has new music out. Let me go find it. And I went to find it. And it was this lyric video. And I thought, okay, I know everybody's doing lyric videos now. But is this the official video? It seems like it's on her little Vivo site there. And so, and by the way, these lyric videos, they have really brought, you know, typography back to you know, the visual media. I kind of like some of them. Yeah, I was a little confused about that myself, as much as I was confused about where I should go to look at the new U2 song.
Well, that was easy. Go to Facebook.
I didn't know that. I went to Facebook. I was like, well, I don't want to watch this video on Facebook where the quality might not be as good and the viewing experience not as good as it is over on YouTube. So I went over to YouTube trying to find it. And there were people that had like skimmed it off of Facebook and had put it on YouTube. But that was not the official video. The official video was indeed on Facebook. And I don't know. I just don't find that the quality of their videos are as, and the viewing experience to be as good.
Really? You don't make it full screen and what's the difference?
I guess I should do that, but yeah, I should do that.
But I mean, isn't it the same video? You're saying their streaming bit rate or something is lower?
Yeah, like it's compressed a little more. When I'm looking at it when it's not full screen, then the viewing experience is not as good.
Well, if you wanted to hear another Taylor Swift song, you should, of course, turn in the Alabama FSU football game because that was all over football, strangely enough. They were playing it during the breaks and other stuff. Taylor Swift, talk about being everywhere. If she's on, you know, football, college football games in prime time, that's really, you know, covering the waterfront. But we'll talk about her later in the show. She's probably too busy to listen in. But if she does, what will she hear us talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll look at the quietest weekend at the box office in years. Okay, the baby's asleep. Don't wake it. And Michael will try again to convince us that the sky is not falling. The U.S. box office is poised for its second highest grossing year in box office history, and worldwide box office is on track for record highs. Nonetheless, the stocks of major theater chains are cratering. We'll get a little Jim Cramer on you and decide if now is the time to buy, buy, buy. And by the way, okay, if you don't know who Jim Cramer is because you live, say, outside the United States,
lucky you.
I was just going to say, this is the definition of ignorance is bliss. During our book filter segment, Michael will wonder why the most successful series by one of the most successful writers of all time has never been turned into a TV series or movie franchise. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss a report by Goldman Sachs that claims the music industry is poised for explosive. Make that historic. No, make that unbelievable growth. And we don't believe it. We'll also see how Taylor Swift and Bruce Springsteen are trying to frustrate scalpers, or are they just frustrating fans? In fact, Michael and I have a first-person story to tell you about that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office or lack thereof.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. And you, the listeners. And the number one movie around the world is Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk. Another $40 million on the weekend, $460 million worldwide. It opened in China, where it was number one with $30 million. So that's where most of its money came this week. It's clearly going to hit the $500 million mark easily. So a big success story for a movie with basically no stars. A story people don't know a lot about. I mean, you know, we take this as a given, but this is hardly a slam dunk. It's a $100 million film whose main draw is the director, and Christopher Nolan is a big draw as a director. He's kind of almost the Spielberg of today, where people will go see any movie he makes, and he's proven that again with this one.
Yeah, I mean, I finally saw it in 70mm in IMAX, and it was stunning. I mean, like 90% of the film, it looks like, is shot in IMAX. You know, I had to say, when I went and did the box office for this week for our show notes, I copied and pasted the US box office in its place. But I had to wonder, because first off, Dunkirk was number one in the world. So I wondered, is The Hitman's Bodyguard really the number one movie? And it was, and literally with the same numbers as it was the week before. Hitman's Bodyguard had the same number from last week. Annabelle Creation had the same number from last week. The only difference was Wind River was now in third place.
Yeah, it was a very quiet week in North America. It is a holiday weekend, usually not a big weekend for box office, but maybe some laggard film opens up with the vain hope that it'll draw some audience. But basically, it was the holdovers did pretty well. They benefited from the fact that there was no competition. So Hitman's Bodyguard, Annabelle Creation, the movies that were already winning kept winning. But it was a very quiet week at the box office, no doubt about that. But, you know, if it's a quiet week in Texas, well, that would be because of the storm. But if it's a quiet week in, you know, Georgia and Florida, but it's busy in California and New York, you don't care. So worldwide box office, there's a lot going on, and people were going to the movies in other countries. And that's why The Hitman's Bodyguard is number two for the week, $28 million on the weekend. It's just hitting the $100 million mark. So that's a big success story right off the bat. They said it cost about $30 million. It's already tripled its budget. It's still going strong. This is one in the win column.
Yeah, I mean, you say that, look, if Texas is closed, you know, you don't care if people are going in other places. The reality is, when one section of the country, let's say it's the Northeast because of a snowstorm, when you're opening a movie and you have that much of the country not being able to see films, it does affect the bottom line. Now, in this case, it was pretty much the entire, that whole section of Texas all the way into...
Well, the whole country wasn't going to the movies this weekend.
That's true, too. Yeah, I mean, you're right.
And number three is Annabelle Creation, another $25 million on the weekend, $250 million worldwide. That looks like it could hit $300 million. So much better than the first Annabelle, and another big hit for the Conjuring universe. And number four, Despicable Me 3, another big hit. That's about to hit the $1 billion mark. That'll do that this week or next weekend at the end. It grossed $12 million this weekend. It's at $993 million. Clearly, there will be a Despicable Me 4. There will, however, not be a new Valerian. Valerian in the City of 1,000 Planets grossed $11 million on the weekend. That's at $200 million worldwide. So China's given it a little boost, but it's probably not going to be enough. And I don't know if there are any other big territories for it to play out in.
In North America, literally, there's just a dash. It did not play in North America at all.
Well, it's closed. Yeah. It's done. It played itself out, but it grossed about $40 million in the U.S. and $160 million in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So Luc Besson, as always, is a much bigger draw worldwide than he is in North America. That's been the case for almost all of his films. But in this case, it's underperforming, so it's doing, you know, better business, but not enough to make it up. And number six is Cars 3, another $10 million on the weekend, also due to China, $350 million worldwide. And number seven, we have a new film finally. It's Silver Soul, or Gintama. It's a Japanese live-action comedy based on a manga about samurais versus aliens. Remember that movie Cowboys versus Aliens? They could have called the manga Samurais versus Aliens. It's set in the Edo period, so it's not modern samurais. But the aliens come, they invade the Earth, and all sorts of stuff happens. It already opened in Japan. Now it's opened somewhere else. So it made $9 million on the weekend, and it's at $42 million worldwide. So I'm not sure where territories it's playing in now. Maybe the Middle Kingdom. I don't know. The Emoji Movie is at number eight, $9 million on the weekend, $160 million worldwide, another big hit. At number nine, the Tom Cruise film. It continues to open up in other overseas territories. It's in 35 countries now. It's made about $9 million on the weekend and $20 million total. So it, as far as we can tell, it's opening pretty soft, pretty much everywhere. People are not flocking to this, but I don't think there's any really big territories yet. So we'll have to see once it hits North America and China and Japan, the countries where he's a really big star, if he can make it up. But, you know, Doug Liman, a really good, you know, he's made some very good films. It's his first movie in a long time. I don't know what's been taking him so long, you know, I'm still interested in checking it out. At number 10 around the world is Wolf Warrior 2, $8 million on the weekend, $853 million worldwide. The Dark Tower just hits $100 million. Wind River is the big hit here in North America. It's a nice indie film doing pretty well. It cost $11 million to make, and it's now hit $22 million. So when all is said and done, it hasn't really opened up anywhere else too much. It's gonna be fine. And number 13, another movie that we can push into the win column, Atomic Blonde. It started off slow. People weren't sure if this Charlize Theron action film would pay off, but it's hit $90 million. So it too has tripled its reported budget. You know, we can only go on what we hear. If we think the budget is way out of whack, we'll say so. But, you know, it's a small, scrappy little film. It's tripled its budget. It's not done yet, so it'll probably do better than that. You know, what can you do? It looks like it's a win. And certainly when all is said and done, I mean, when we talk about a movie being a win, we're not talking about its whole financial life. We're just saying, is it a clear smash hit right out of the bat just from box office alone, right?
Yeah, because of course, as you know, you could lose money theatrically, but then, you know, ultimately, you're not trying to, but ultimately you could win by, you know, ancillary markets, home video, licensing for pay TV and premium pay TV and Netflix. And by the time you're done, you go, well, OK, that movie, OK, it wasn't a huge hit. It didn't, break the bank, but it didn't break the bank in the other way either. We didn't lose a ton of money either.
Yeah, you're not looking to make three sequels to it, but you're perfectly happy with it. And that not only does happen, it happens all the time. That's how Hollywood works.
Pretty much.
That's, you know, most movies, you know, don't lose money when all is said and done.
I mean, when you look at a Logan Lucky, which I know is coming up here on the charts, okay, this one, yeah, maybe that's a bad example because, you know, it's probably just going to break even worldwide in its gross, okay, and maybe go a little bit further theatrically. And you know they didn't spend a lot marketing it. They told you they didn't spend a lot marketing it. So let's just say all in, it's $40 million and they kind of get to $28 million. That one, they're taking it in the shorts on that one. So.
Okay, I don't know what you're talking about. The movie's just at under $30 million. All right,
you know
it made $5.7 million
this
weekend.
I'm going to scratch that one. It was just a bad film to pick.
It's a good film to pick because it's an example of a film that wherever they end up on the worldwide box office, they're probably not going to lose money on it. It's obviously not going to be a big hit, but they're at $27 million worldwide. It costs about $30 million to make and another $10 to market, at least in North America. But it also has big names. And it's gotten good reviews. So it's probably a film that's going to play quite well on video on demand and pay-per-view and DVD and Blu-ray and be a valuable piece of property to have for cable and premium cable and, you know, network. So it's going to sell around the globe and people are going to see it. And it will probably be just fine when all is said and done, don't you think?
I mean,
it's not a hit, but they're not going to lose money on this movie.
And what they would actually tell you, the producers of this film, would say, hey, we already sold off most of the rights anyway in other territories, so we did the exact same thing that most filmmakers do.
Indie, small filmmakers. Correct. Filmmakers who have their own movie. We're not talking about studio films, but yeah, when you're making your own scrappy film, you sell it off to make sure you're going to be okay.
So we were fine the moment that the film was released, although I would say they really did need to make more money in North America.
Well, I'm sure they would have liked to, absolutely, but again, they're not going to lose money. Yeah. At number 15, a movie that's definitely making money is Baby Driver. They hit $207 million worldwide, so that's a big hit. Spider-Man Homecoming, another hit, $750 million worldwide. Looking down for a new movie, here's one. What Happened to Monday?
I don't know.
It's a sci-fi thriller. I do not know how to say her name.
Oh, you mean Noomi Rapace?
Noomi Rapace, thank you. I totally forgot to look that up. Yes, it stars Noomi Rapace and... Willem Dafoe, and I think Glenn Close has a small role in it. It's a movie. It opened up in, played the festival circuit. It's now opened up theatrically, and it's made about $4.5 million on the weekend, so not a very good opening. It's from Netflix. They saw it at a film festival. They bought it for what was described as mid-seven figures. So I'm going to say, give that a number of $7 million. Who knows what it was, but they picked it up for $7 million. It got middling reviews, but they're opening it in six or seven territories and made almost $5 million. I don't know what to make of this movie, except Netflix is showing that they can release movies theatrically.
No, because they only did it in foreign territory. They did not do it in North America. It made no money in North America. Who knows who's releasing this movie in other places? They may have only purchased the North American rights.
They purchased multiple territories, but not worldwide. You're quite right.
So, you know, basically this could be a standard, you know, film distribution where, you know, let's say they didn't pick it up for the UK or they didn't pick it up in Australia. It was released theatrically in those areas. It made $5 million in those territories. Here in the US, where Netflix does have it and did pick it up, they don't report box office. So they not only don't report viewership on their own platform, they don't
box
report
box office. What box office? What do you mean?
Well, they do release films to theaters, the iPIC theaters. They have a deal with iPIC, which shows their films, but they do not report box office for them. So when Okja played here in Los Angeles and in New York, there was no box office for it. You have no idea how well or how popular What Happened to Monday is here in the United States, whether you know how many people watched on Netflix or how many people went to see it in a movie theater.
My question is, isn't this again an example of, I mean, who are we to tell Netflix they're not doing it right? But don't you feel like they're losing out on possibilities? I mean, this probably isn't a very good movie or a good example for them, but, you know, it just seems like the visibility of your films is so much better when you play in the movie theaters. You know, if it's a good movie, it just gets you money and attention. And then when it comes to Netflix, people go, oh, yeah, I want to see that. If I turn on Netflix and I see some movie I've never heard of with Willem Dafoe and Glenn Close, I know some people click on it, but more often I would think I'd be like, what the hell is that?
You know, more and more, and I probably should get a standard answer for this since the question is asked of me more and more, given, you know, my vocation. I would say if you look at the difference between Amazon, which has taken a straightforward film distribution route, versus Netflix, which is obviously kind of biased toward its own platform, you can really see the benefit of releasing some films, specifically the films Amazon has picked up, in movie theaters, because you can actually name them and you know what they are. The Big Sick is an example of that. It is benefiting from having earned nearly $40 million, more than $40 million, in movie theaters and will benefit from exposure during awards season and once it hits premium cable and once it hits the Amazon platform itself. Netflix, however, To the Bone is a movie that got a lot of buzz out of Sundance. Yet when I saw it on the Netflix, you know, they have the little the front page there where you see all these movies that they're promoting. I'm like, To the Bone, it sounds familiar, but I couldn't remember exactly what it was. Well, when I went to look it up 3 days later, I went, oh, yeah, it's that Sundance movie. Well, I had no idea because it got none of the buzz and none of the hype and none of the press that going into a movie theater sometimes generates.
But maybe it's the quality of the films. Maybe Netflix is picking up movies that are kind of straight to video, as we would say in the old days. You know what? That Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon movie, they play in theater. It just wasn't a good movie. You know, this movie, not a good movie from all accounts.
Well, so that's
maybe
true.
Maybe they are straight to video. Maybe that is the sort of thing that you just want to trick people. You want to stock the shelves of Blockbuster, and they walk and go, oh, I know Ryan Reynolds, and they pick that movie, whatever it is, just because they'd recognize a star in it. Even though they don't care that they haven't seen reviews and stuff, they do, oh, I'll watch that. People fall for that less and less because if they're on Netflix, you might go, oh, what do Rotten Tomatoes say? But, you know, maybe they're just picking bad movies.
Yeah.
Okja was not a good movie. That wasn't going to benefit from a big theatrical run because it was junk. It was not a good movie.
I would say that Netflix has the best of both worlds because they can look at a movie and go, okay, this goes into the theaters and then we'll hold it. But the problem, of course, then that puts their own platform as second fiddle, which they do not want to do.
It's not second fiddle. Yeah, I just don't think it's second fiddle. I think it's still, I think if they can make hay with a movie, they should release that because why not? It just increases the value of the film. And if it's just straight to video, that's fine too. Sometimes you want an event that only works on TV. That's what a series is. I mean, there's stuff you make just for that because that's the best platform for it. But other things with a big wide focus or big battle scenes, you know, benefits for being in a theater. Oh, well.
Well, we should say that we had a little technical glitch, okay, Michael, and we had to stop recording, and then you had to reboot your computer, and while you were rebooting your computer, I watched the trailer to What Happened to Monday, and it has a wonderful setup. It has a great setup, and then it looks like it turns into a big action film. It looks like a Gattaca setup, like a futuristic Gattaca kind of setup, and then it just turns into a blow-em-up type movie.
Well, it's a future where population is so overgrown, you can't have children. You're only allowed one kid, a policy that used to be in place in China, and it's put in place worldwide. And a mother gives birth to seven daughters and dies in childbirth, and the father hides them all and gives them each a name, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And so they each play the same person, and they're only allowed to go out into the world one day a week. So right. One girl Saturday only gets to go out on Saturday. And then it becomes this complicated murder mystery when they each try to go out and find out where the other one was. But it's kind of a funny, interesting premise where, you know, you only get to go out on Tuesdays because your name is Tuesday, and you have to play the role of, you know, that's one person. And so everybody else comes home and tells you what happened that day, I guess, so you know what to do. You know, slap the guy at work the next time So it's an interesting premise, and apparently they didn't pull it off.
Yeah. Well,
so looking down for more movies, there's a little more confusion here. Well, Girls Trip, $125 million worldwide, another success story. War for the Planet of the Apes is looking at $370 million. Wonder Woman, that's doing much better. That's at $812 million. And then right below it are two new movies. One is Gogol Nacholo, something like that.
Should say it's Gogol Nacholo.
Yes, Gogol Nacholo. And it's apparently, like, we hear the word Gogol, of course you think of, you know, Gogol, Nikolai Gogol, the great writer. And in fact, that's what the movie's about. It's a Russian period mystery adventure about Nikolai Gogol and a cop who team up. And Gogol suffers from epileptic seizures, and they realize that during his seizures, he comes up with clues to solve crimes, and they run around solving crimes. So if that isn't odd enough, that seems to be what the movie is. It opened to $3 million in one territory, presumably Russia. But from all I can gather online, it's 48 minutes long? Surely that's not right. If you know what's going on with Gogol Nacholo, for God's sakes, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. It is facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. And theaters want bums in seats, and they don't care what they have to do it. Boxing, opera, whatever. And so last week or 2 weeks ago, we had Terminator, a re-release of Terminator 2. That's in the theaters. It's still there on some screens. This weekend, we had Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the 40th anniversary. They didn't just play it for like two nights only like they normally do, or one night only. They're running it all day, every day for an entire week, it looks like. It's still on here in Alabama, and it made almost $2.3 million worldwide. Or that's actually North America. I think it's in 33 territories, actually. So it's pulling in some money around the world. Not a lot, obviously, but then it was topped by a TV show.
What?
Yes, Marvel's Inhumans. The first two episodes of a TV show that are going to debut played in movie theaters, and people paid money to see in advance. That played in 66 territories, and it grossed $2.6 million. Normally, you would say, well, that's so little money. Does that really matter? But I guess are they paying digital right print fees? You know, are they paying to release it in all those territories, or is it cheaper?
They pay a special screening fee, and I'm sure that was from like one or two different showings. It was not all all weekend long.
So they got a special rate, and they probably got a special rate because it was a TV show and just a special event, and they worked that out. And so that's probably profitable for everyone, and it certainly brings attention to the TV show.
Correct. Yes, that's really what they're doing it for, and I wouldn't be surprised. I think it's ABC. If ABC is paying to actually market through Fathom Events and elsewhere to actually, you know, play the film or play the series that way, the first two episodes that way.
It's produced by ABC Studios, and it will be airing on ABC starting September 29th. So it was a good news at the weekend box office in North America, however, because the summer looks like it's at a 25-year low, but the Labor Day weekend was only at a 20-year low. So that's kind of things are looking up.
Oh, it's one way you're really trying to make lemonade out of lemons there.
That's right. But worldwide box office is up. Thanks mostly to China, their box office has soared 24% during the first 9 months of the year. So, she to Wolf Warriors 2 and all the other hits in China. But that's the story that everybody's talking about. After a dismal summer, says the New York Times, Hollywood pins its hopes on the fall.
Yes. I mean, and, you know, all of the theater companies, the exhibitors, the movie theater chains, they say, look, yeah, third quarter is a loss. Okay, it's going to be a loss. Don't expect it to be, you know, we're not going to break even. It's not going to, you know, the numbers won't be the same as last year. In fact, they could be down, you know, 20%. They're down 20%, or 16% at least. But, you know, that third quarter we have high hopes for because there's lots of big movies like Thor, there's lots, and Star Wars and others. And, of course, you got the big awards contenders coming out. So we really have high hopes for the fourth quarter of this year.
Right. Last week is Despair. Next week is the Stephen King adaptation, It, which looks like it's tracking to be the biggest September opening of all time.
That's right.
Will people immediately, oh, everything's great again? I mean, are people just, you know, every week they just float in the wind based on whatever that weekend's box office was? Or can they take the long view ever?
I think very few people, especially analysts, take the long view. Everything is always the sky is falling. It's the end of movies. It's always the end of movies. I've been hearing about the end of movies since I was a kid. You know, the VCR was going to be the end of movies. Now, every time that the box office dips for a quarter or two, it's the end of movies. As you know, Michael, and as our listeners know, or our longtime listeners, my biggest concern is always attendance, not box office, but attendance. You want people going to the movies, making a habit out of movie going, and you want people of all ages making a habit out of going to the movies. You don't want to get to a point where it's like opera or theater going, where you have to ask people to turn down their hearing aids because, you know, it's only people who are 70 and older going to a specific art exhibit or a specific movie or a specific art event like movie going or opera.
Mm-hmm. And the analysts are down on movie going, and people who buy stocks are down on, because AMC is down 45% since Memorial Day. Their stock has collapsed. Regal is down 28%. Cinemark, which is also owned by AMC, those are down 18%. I guess those will get combined at some point soon.
What, Cinemark is different than Carmike. Carmike.
Oh, Carmike. I beg your pardon. Carmike is the one that was consumed by AMC.
Correct. And so, yes, you've got, you know, people, I would imagine that a lot of this has to do with two things. One, box office is down. Okay, let's face it. This year, box office will not be as good as it was last year. Okay.
Last year was the highest grossing year of all time. If you set the second highest grossing year of all time, why would stocks collapse? The fundamentals seem to be the same.
Well,
that theater going is a good business.
Keep in mind, you've got people day trading and things like that, thus stock dips.
But not 45%.
No, not for, well, that's AMC, and they have other issues, including debt load, and, you know, they have the worry of being owned by Wanda, you might recall, which we've discussed on previous episodes, and gee, do they have enough money to survive without Wanda?
So you're worried about exhibitors and their business? You think they're bad businesses? You wouldn't invest in them? If you see AMC stock fall another 20, 30%, you wouldn't say, you know what? I might just buy some stock in AMC because I know the fundamentals are good. And when these morons who are selling off the stock suddenly hear about record box office at Christmas time or certainly next summer, they're going to buy the stock again and bring it back up. Or do you think there's something fundamentally off about exhibitors and theater going that it's a bad business to invest in?
Well, okay. I mentioned one of the two things that I thought was driving the stock prices down. One was the box office. And this will answer your other question. The second thing, and might be more important, is the uncertainty over premium video on demand. And so on all of these earnings calls for all of these movie chains, they all talk about that their discussions with the studios have remained constant, that there has been no increase or decrease in the time frame of when PVOD will arrive. And that is, they have no idea when it will arrive, but it's not going to be in 2017 and probably not in the first part of 2018. Because nobody wants the same thing. Disney doesn't want it at all, so take them off the table. And nobody the chains aren't going to do it unless it benefits them. And
right.
And the studios don't they're not all playing on the same with the same terms. So nobody, it's kind of a stalemate, and it's been a stalemate for 7 years. However, investors think they always feel it's going to happen next month. So
I'm not asking what the morons think. I'm asking what you think.
I think that
it's December and Warner Brothers says we're releasing Justice League day and date. Premium video on demand. People can pay $30 in their home 18 days after the movie opens. Are you as AMC going to carry that film or Regal or Cinemark?
I think you're going to take a stand on that one. And I have a feeling that the movie theaters would not show it.
Right. Of course not. That's what happened the last time they tried to do it. Why in God's name would they agree to it?
And what I would also say is the only way that I think theaters could be pushed into this, and these are the public theaters, the theaters that have gone public and have shareholders, is if the uncertainty over PVOD over an extended period of time brings their stock price so low that they have to finally settle the issue with studios, where they say, look, if we don't settle this, our stock price is only going to decline further. So that is when you listen to someone like Adam Aaron over at AMC, he's done the investor tours and he said, look, all anybody cares about, they don't care about box office, they don't care about reseating where we're putting in recliners and the per, you know, sales per person is increasing in those venues. They don't care about theater renovations. They only want to know about premium video on demand and when it's coming and how it's going to
be. You say never. And if I'm AMC, I say never. We're never going to show a movie in our theater that's available 15 days later on premium video on demand. We won't do it. No big studio film. We won't do it. Why not?
What they say is and this is what's keeping the door open, is we won't do anything that doesn't benefit our business directly. Meaning, we won't do that unless we're getting a cut of the PVOD pie. That's effectively that's kind of like the unspoken is, sure, we'll do it if we're a profit participant in premium video on demand. What I would say is, guess who else is profit participants, movie theater chains? Movie stars. And why don't you go ask them or their lawyers how well that worked out for them?
Well, they're not going to be talking about net. They're going to be talking about gross, first dollar gross. But they're not going to do that. And the studios aren't going to give it to them. And it's not going to happen. What possible reason would you say yes to agreeing to undercut your entire business model?
None.
You're telling me, well, their stock's falling, so they're going to have to take a bad business deal because otherwise their stock will fall.
Well, it could be a combination of factors in the stock price and then the studio saying, fine, if you're saying never and you won't agree to this to kind of balance out your stock and kind of plateau your stock so that it can keep growing again and maybe be a little more stable, fine, we want 70% of film rental.
Well, yeah, they can always withhold their movie. They can say, all right, they don't need to have premium video on demand to say we want 70% of the box office, do they? They say, we've got the new Star Wars movie. Give us 70% of the box office. Well, what does AMC say to that? They say, no, thank you.
Well, if they did that with AMC, that could hurt them because AMC is, you know, a huge chunk of the market. Regal is the same thing. You could actually harm your movie at those circuits by not opening in those circuits.
Of course. Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Right. Well, you know, looking at the summer season, which is a disaster, of course, but of course, spring was the best ever. So again, you keep saying the box office is down. It's not. It's the second highest box office of all time. That is not bad news. The box office has spread out to 12 months of the year. That's not bad news. That's good news. The exhibitors have been crying for it since day one. Don't just release all your movies in the summer and November, December. They're now doing that. They're now releasing big budget movies in February and March and April and September and all, you know, 12 months out of the year. That's good news, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look, and Adam Aaron over at AMC will tell you, January through mid-April, I think box office was up 4%, I think is what he was saying. Of course, then April through, you know, today, it's down.
No, the first quarter was the fourth best of all time. The second quarter, the second quarter was the best of all time. So again, the summer's down, but winter and spring did great. Fall will do great. Relax. 17 movies came out this summer with budgets of $50 million or more. We could go down to $40 million or $30 million. The news just gets better, frankly. But there were 17 films, actually just 15. I included two non-Hollywood movies. Of those 17 films, 10 were hits, clearly. One was a wash and 6 were flops. That sounds about normal, doesn't it? Does that sound like a disaster? The flops, you know, one of the flops was not even a Hollywood movie. It was Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets.
Yeah. You know? Well, and you had some really, you had clunkers this year. Let's face it. You had the King Arthur movie.
Hollywood, yeah, that was one of the flops that they've been sitting on it for ages because they knew it was bad. Dark Tower did poorly. But then you have three other flops. War for the Planet of the Apes, which made $375 million. Cars 3 and Alien Covenant. All three got pretty good reviews. All three are sort of valuable parts of a franchise. Cars 3, you could argue, if that brings them $1 billion in toy sales, it's not the worst decision to have made that movie. They're not disasters. Valerian is a disaster. King Arthur is a disaster. But those three, they're not hits. They're flops at the box office. But when all is said and done.
Well, again, it's a herd mentality. So you're asking why our stock's falling. Well, everybody else is selling. I better sell too before I lose my shirt. Mm-hmm. That's the way the stock market works. That's the way herd mentality works. And you look at stuff like this, and you know, the Planet of the Apes movie didn't make money. Sell, sell, sell. And everybody else starts going, well, now the stock that I purchased is worthless. I better sell before I lose a lot of money.
Well, that's how you make money, by being smarter than all the other people.
Just ask Warren Buffett.
And saying, that's it. You say, you know what? I'm looking at the 2018 summer releases, and there's so many movies that people are excited by. I don't care if they're parts of franchises. There's so many movies that people are going to be chomping at the bit to see, and most of them look like surefire winners. Even if they're not good movies, they're going to make a lot of money. That I know, summer 2018, they're going to say, oh my God, it's the best box office of all time. It's amazing. And stocks are going to go back up, aren't they?
I have a feeling that is correct, yes.
So if you want to make money, you say, these people are idiots, and I'm going to buy my stock right now.
But if I wanted to read a great book, what would I say?
You'd say, go to BookFilter, because BookFilter is a book lover's best friend. It's time for us to check out BookFilter and Michael's picks for which new releases are ready to be optioned. Michael, what should Hollywood be reading?
I love this.
Wait a second. Who am I? What is...
I love this. This is like artificial intelligence with somebody who's intelligent.
No, that's pretty artificial. You can just sit back and relax, Berlin.
Okay. So seriously, what books do you have for us? Because I know we're getting into the fall book season, right? I mean...
Oh, it's getting heavy. And when I'm going through the books each week, it suddenly it's like, there's 500 mysteries coming out this week. And there's a lot of books coming out. That's
I know
sure.
That there's like the summer beach book season, which we're long past. But now we're into the heavy, like, hey, you want to buy, you know, you want to buy this stuff for... the holiday season. And this is when like Colson's Whitehead's last book came out last year, The Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm. There's always great books all year round, really. I mean, with a couple hundred thousand books coming out, you know, every week is chock full of books, but certainly this is a blockbuster season. You've got the tie-in to the Vietnam War, the Ken Burns documentary that's airing on PBS soon. That's just come out. You've got a new spy thriller by Jean Le Carré, which is a sequel to his breakthrough hit, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. You've got Darwin's Backyard, which is this fun sort of history biography book about the scientist and how his entire home was the site of endless experimentation and observation. And he involved his entire family. I mean, apparently everywhere you stepped, there was some crazy little interesting experiment going on. It's kind of a fun, different spin on Darwin, who people just picture saying, there is no God, which isn't, you know, really what he did all his time. And there's even A Secret History of Witches, which is a fun fantasy novel. It's sort of a romp through five generations of witches in the UK from the 1800s through World War II. So there's lots of, everywhere you turn, there's interesting books who are already movies, already TV shows, or Springsteen's coming to Broadway and his biography just came out in paperback. That's a great book. But my pick of the week is Secrets in Death. It's the latest book by J.D. Robb. Do you know J.D. Robb?
Yeah, is it a she? Because I think isn't it like a pen name for like another... like really well-known mystery writer, and like they write all these series of books.
Not a mystery writer, but a romance writer. Yeah, Nora Roberts. Nora Roberts is one of the most successful writers of all time. An endless string of novels keeps coming out. And under the pen name J.D. Robb, she writes sort of near future cop procedurals with a dash of romance. And this series, it's book number 45. It stars Eve Dallas. She's a detective in New York City. She's married to an incredibly wealthy man, so she's a cop who lives on Central Park West. That's always nice to be. And in this case, she's investigating the death of a gossip columnist, a woman who used her information to blackmail the rich and powerful, which means pretty much everybody wanted her dead. And my question is, Nora Roberts should ring a bell. She is unbelievably successful. She's just sold hundreds of millions of copies of books. She's got hundreds and hundreds of titles. Every other week, she's got a new book coming out, and she writes them on her own, James Patterson. And just very few of her books have been turned into films, even her romances. And this series, it's a cop show. It's a procedural. It's set in the near future. It's got an ongoing heroine. Why has this not been turned into a TV show or movie? I'm scratching my head.
I'm wondering if maybe a couple things. One, maybe she is difficult to deal with. And by that, I don't mean her.
Why would we say that?
I don't mean personally. I mean her managers and agents are saying, we want $1 trillion. In which case, you know, the studios are saying, yeah, we're not going to do that. So that's what I mean by difficult. I don't mean on a personal level, on a, you know, like where she's just difficult. I mean her business folks and her terms are difficult to deal with. Or somebody has picked it up and hasn't been able to make a go of it yet.
But I haven't seen any reports of like, oh, Eve Dallas has been optioned for the movies or the TV show, you know, something like that. Maybe, you know, she doesn't need it, obviously. I mean, she has literally hundreds of books to her credit. More come out all the time. Maybe she just feels like they're not going to do it right and she can't be bothered.
Yeah, that, I mean, she might have an aversion to working in Hollywood entirely. So that's another one. That's a...
Certainly the books that have been turned into movies are sort of like TV movies. They haven't been very good. So it's a pretty unimpressive, you know. So she may have seen those and been like, eh.
And actually, if you look at it, okay, Nora Roberts' books to be adapted. This is from April 7th, 2008. Mandalay, Stephanie Germain, and Tandem Team. So Mandalay Television teamed with a bunch of other producers to turn her books into a television series for the Lifetime Network.
Yes, no, and those are the adaptations that I saw. And they, you know, sort of came and went. Maybe they did well for Lifetime. There were like 8 or 10 of them. Not any particular series or books, just a string of, you know, Lifetime movies. And that feels like her natural audience. But this one, I don't know. It's a cop. It's a procedural. It's hugely successful. It's book number 45. She's one of the best known authors in the world. You think it would happen?
Well, maybe she just got like she got burned and she's like, you know what? I don't want to. No more of that. I don't want it anymore.
Yep.
But if they do, actually, if somebody options her books, I would imagine it would be headline news.
It would be huge news. It would be gargantuan news. It would be big.
Ooh, well, then in that case, it might be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Last week, Michael described people waiting to hear a favorite new song on the radio and then pouncing on the radio to turn up the volume. He immediately followed that with a joke saying kids had no idea what he was talking about. But a new study says it's not a joke. Traditional radio is losing its grip on millennials. A new study from NYU insists teens self-report listening to AM, FM radio 50% less in the past decade and discovering new music. That happens on YouTube and Pandora and Spotify before it happens on the radio. In a year or two, 75% of all new cars will have digital services and ways to plug in your phone easily, and the old cars without that option are about to be retired to the junkyard. Add in smart speakers in the home like Alexa, and you have some serious challenges. By the way, we just set off about 50,000 Alexas. In response, the National Association of Broadcasters said, nonsense! They cited their own statistics to say teens still listen to a lot of radio while acknowledging that the digitally connected car with phone options poses a major challenge. But given the wasted money of online ads, radio gives advertisers the best bang for their buck and can be hyper-local. So radio rocks! Big deal or big whoop?
I'm not sure. You know, the initial study, I said, wait a second. They're saying teens self-report listening to AM, FM radio. Well, that's not a great way to measure how much people are actually listening. What do they say they're doing as opposed to what they're actually doing? So that made me a little suspicious of it. But their general argument, like, hey, people are used to on demand in the car. You know, radio is not king anymore. That sort of tickled me. Oh, sounds like it should be believable. And then you read what the National Association of Broadcasters said, and they said, hey, look at the facts. Here's the information. They're listening to this many hours a week and blah, 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 and they still use radio to discover new music. And I'm like, all right, you got me there. So my head's spinning. I'm not sure what to think.
Well, first of all, Arbitron was always self-reporting, right? So having people self-report radio listening, that's not anything new. Now, of course, they're...
Well, but it wasn't like a monthly diary where they were writing, you know, this was just them saying, how much do you listen to the radio? Oh, I don't listen to it a lot.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
It was like a survey. I don't think it was like, you know, an official diary thing.
Yeah, it's a grain of salt type of thing. I don't necessarily know how much I take that as truth.
But the idea that, you know, the car is the great last bastion of radio. And then in the homes where people used to have radios, you know, on a kitchen counter, now you've got Alexa or you've got Google or you've got some other speaker. You know, you've got streaming services. When you used to go into restaurants and cafes, they'd have the radio on. Now they have their own, you know, mix of music, or they're playing a Pandora playlist, or they're doing something like that. And that's true. That happens a lot. So traditional terrestrial radio is its natural territory shrinking? Is it like one of those wild creatures where, you know, civilization keeps encroaching and they have less and less land to roam? I feel like that might be happening.
I would agree with that. I mean, certainly I never listen to the radio at home, and I do listen to it in the car because that's where NPR is.
Fresh Air
with Terry Gross. Michael, I'm wondering on your notebook.
I hate you, Terry Gross. I want your job.
Yeah, she has the best job in the world. She interviews pretty much everyone and has for 20 some odd years, maybe 30. I mean, God, yeah. If you look up Terry Gross, if you don't know who she is, and listen to her show.
She's a vampire. She's a vampire. She's been doing it so long.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. Speaking of vampires, proving she has no intention of ever running for office again.
Oh.
I figured that would be an interesting segue here because we're talking about Hillary Clinton, who announced a book tour to promote her upcoming memoir due out September 12th, along with traditional book signings, such as her tour's kickoff at the DC Indie Politics and Prose Convention. Clinton will also be doing at least 15 speaking engagements. They'll be held in larger venues with tickets costing about $50 and up. And I do mean up, by the way, because VIP tickets, guess what? They include a meet and greet with Hillary Clinton. Great. They also could cost $3,000. Yeah, not going to pay it. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess, in the scheme of things, but it is a big disappointment. I mean, if you want to have a voice in public policy, it helps to have a little sort of, you know, sense of what will play well. And this doesn't play well. It's stupid. It's like, come on. Don't you want to be able to speak up? She's not going to run for president again. She's too old. But for God's sake, woman, you know, you shouldn't have gone to Wall Street and opened your purse, even though it was perfectly legal. It just didn't play well. And this doesn't play well either. It really irks.
Well, I mean, you say she's too old, but then, you know, she is the same age as Trump, who will run again. Right. And
no, I don't know that at all.
Well, true.
You're assuming he'll stay in office. I'm sure he'll run again if he's there and he can. Why not? You know, he's cashing out. But no, I don't. She will not run again in 2024.
No.
I mean, in 2020. No, she won't run.
No, I would agree with that. Bernie Sanders, would be, you know, he was 74. He's too old, too.
Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they're all too old, I think. They're not going to be, even if they think they're going to run, they're not going to be running for president in 2020. But just to be a public figure, this just feels, you know, you're talking about the election and how you won the popular vote and you want to weigh in on the issues of the day, charging thousands of dollars for a meet and greet to promote your memoir just doesn't sit well.
What would be better if could she charge $50 for these like huge speaking engagements?
Well, that's what she's doing for most people.
Right. And there are people who go out on tour. And I think Hillary Clinton was one of them at one point. I think after she came like to the Thousand Oaks Civic Center here in California. And if you were a part of the quote unquote speaker series, which you paid like $200 for the year, and they had like four or five different speakers, that's kind of like paying $50 to hear one person speak. But, You know, because ultimately there's four or five of them and you paid $200 and you got to see five people speak. I know Colin Powell was another one of them. What's the difference? That she's doing it on her own?
But she's charging thousands of dollars.
Over the meet and greets and stuff like that. Yeah.
No, $50 is fine. You know, I mean, that's what David Sedaris does. I mean, it's whatever. I mean, she's having traditional book signings, which will be mobbed by thousands of people. She's having big speaking venues in larger arenas. Great, fine. $50, you know, it's a lot of money, but okay. But, you know, $3,000, it's just tacky. It's the optics are bad.
Ultimately, $3,000 meet and greets, bad. Save the planet from global warming like Al Gore, good.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, actor Paul Bettany has gone from respected actor in a serious drama to a major player in franchise flicks. First, he popped into the Avengers franchise, the Avengers universe, and now he's joining Star Wars. Director Ron Howard reported from the set of the Han Solo spinoff that Bettany was joining the film, which I thought was pretty much done and over with. Howard and Bettany, of course, worked together on A Beautiful Mind. Howard also later revealed that actor Warwick Davis was joining the cast of the Star Wars movie. Of course, you might recall Davis from Willow. He played Willow. We also...
And the Harry Potter movies, and, you know, suddenly he's part of some of the biggest franchises of all
time.
That's
true. We also know actor Michael K. Williams had to leave the film when another film commitment made it impossible for him to come back and do reshoots. So I guess there's a lot of reshoots taking place. Howard, of course, took over after the original directors from the Lego movie were fired over creative differences. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, you've already said it as an aside. What in God's name is going on? These are not, you're adding actors and roles and characters. This is not a reshoot. I mean, I don't know what they're doing, but he may get directing credit if it's suddenly like 70% of the movie is directed by Ron Howard. I mean, this is, I mean, they're like, oh yeah, Paul Bettany's joined the film during reshoots.
Yeah.
When do people join film during reshoots? And Warwick Davis? Like, what the heck is going on there? So I'd love to see that script. I don't know what's happening. Maybe it's just some small little, but, you know, why would he come in for some small little role or cameo? It doesn't make any sense at all. Well, so either they're dramatically redoing this film or they're blowing up some minor little, you know, guy pops into a scene as if he's joining the film.
And it could be either, and it could just be Ron Howard saying, look, we're changing a few elements. It's a really small role. Warwick, I directed you in Willow. Can you come and just do this for me? And same thing with Paul.
Can you do a guy a solid?
Yeah, right. Speaking of doing solids, Sky TV isn't doing Fox News any solids. The UK satellite TV offering Sky made news this week when it dumped Fox News from the service's lineup. They said the channel had just a few thousand viewers and that the content was so US-centric that it simply offered nothing of interest to their audience. Of course, 21st Century Fox is hoping the UK government will approve its taking over all of Sky, a deal that has been held up by regulatory inquiries questioning whether the company can meet the ethical standards given the recent spate of nonstop sexual harassment lawsuits against on-air talent and in the corporate offices. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. Why were they carrying it in the first place? You know, like, what made them think? And my next question was, well, do they carry MSNBC? I wouldn't think they would. And you check, and apparently they don't. You know, you can't get MSNBC in the UK from what I understand. I saw some petitions online saying we want to watch MSNBC. Maybe it's true now, but as far as I can determine, they're not available. CNN has a worldwide focus. It has CNN International. That makes sense. But Fox News and MSNBC, I just don't understand why you'd carry it in Germany, France, or England anyway.
Facebook has gone live. Yes, like every other digital platform, Facebook has been investing in original content. Now they're making it easier to find that content by launching Watch Video Live. It offers access to hundreds of videos, both short and long, including reality, documentary, and fiction. You'll find everything from videos of a baby hippo at the Cincinnati Zoo to an arts and entertainment prank show to a documentary series based on the photography website Humans of New York. But the real question is whether you'll find any other viewers. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Yeah, there you go.
I was online looking at Facebook Live. There is a 4-minute and 6-second video called the David Bowie Kanye West Conspiracy, or a 7-minute and 39-second video about this guy plays Halo for a living. Or Hala Madrid, a training day at Real Madrid, or Strangers, which seems to be a perhaps reality or perhaps fictional story. This episode is called Honeymooners. So it's 18 minutes long. So, you know, it's there. I've never looked at it, but now I can see it's here. Maybe I'll start watching. I think it's a big whoop, of course, until they get some breakout thing that is so good that everybody wants to watch it. Like Humans of New York. This is a documentary series based on the website where this guy in New York City would say, hey, can I take your picture? Can you tell me about yourself? And he called it Humans of New York, became really popular. Just a portrait of people and a little description of who they are, what they were doing that day or something. Just, you know, the people on the street you see every day, brought them all to life, the diversity and complexity of New York City. And that's been turned into a documentary series. I'm kind of interested in that. I said, oh, you know, I've seen the website. It's cool. Here's Humans of New York. Episode 1 is 22 minutes long. Maybe I'll check it out.
In a first for U.S. football and perhaps any sport, a top analyst has quit ESPN due to concerns over the safety of the game. Former player Ed Cunningham has been outspoken for years about the dangers the sport poses to players. And those concerns have only grown. Now that it's very clear a substantial portion of professional football players face extreme medical issues from playing the game as it is now conducted, Cunningham felt he couldn't, in good conscience, take part anymore. He called up his bosses and quit his six-figure job, even as he survived the latest rounds of cuts and that the network had and could reasonably expect to enjoy his cushy work for decades to come. Apparently, no one has ever quit a broadcasting job over concerns of safety for the sport they cover. Cunningham insists he loves football and merely wants to see it become substantially safer, but that isn't happening. B- big deal or big whoop. And while you answer that, Michael, I will be filling out an application to work at ESPN as a NFL analyst.
Because you have no ethics or morals.
No, none.
I think it's a big deal. It certainly made waves in the industry. It's very telling that somebody would take this sort of stand. It's very, you know, he had a lot of reasons why he quit, and he quit. And then it's only now, a few months later, that he said, you know what, this is another really big reason why I did it. So there were multiple reasons. He has producing jobs and other things going on. He also says he's starting to feel the effects of his career as well as a professional football player. And he thinks he's, you know, losing a step broadcasting wise. And he may have health issues that he's going to have to deal with. But he knows three players personally who have committed suicide. All who were found to have had CTE after death. That's one of the short-term logos, short-term acronyms for one of the traumatic injuries suffered by the brain. So this isn't like some, I feel like the game is like people are killing themselves. Everybody's getting health issues. It's really getting harder and harder to justify the daily brutality what you put your body under when you play football. It's not being played safely. I don't think it can be played safely. Just like boxing. It's just not a safe sport. I don't like to watch boxing, and frankly, I don't watch football.
CTE stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and that's the...
Which is what happens when you get hit 1,000 times during practice.
Correct, and it's, of the head, so yeah.
Yeah, every time your brain gets jarred, not good.
Yeah. Disney is tightening its belt, so just as, Mr. Cunningham is leaving, Disney is tightening its belt. No, Mickey won't have to go on a diet, by the way, but the ABC TV group is dumping 10% of its budget, and that means people will lose their jobs. Those cuts will reach everywhere, from cable channels like Freeform, which is the former ABC family, and Disney Channel to ABC itself, and even local TV stations. It comes in the wake of revenue falling 22% across the group for the first three quarters of this fiscal year. Ultimately, it will mean some 300 jobs at Disney ABC alone are cut. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm not sure. Is that 300 jobs out of the entire, is that 10,000 jobs in the entire Disney universe, or is that 10,000 jobs at ABC alone?
ABC alone. Just ABC, the ABC network, 300 jobs will be cut.
Well, that's 3%?
Well, think about it. They employ 10,000.
Right. So 10% would be 1,000, 1% would be 100. So that's about 3% of their entire workforce is being fired. 300 doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about it, it's 3% of their entire workforce. That actually kind of is a lot. And of course, it's a big deal to anyone involved, but golly, it seems to be their decision. Their choice is always to like fire people.
Well, it's the easiest way to boost revenue is to cut overhead. And one big form of overhead, of course, is payroll.
Well, thank God I know that they don't have to worry about revenue at The Simpsons.
Well, yeah, but before we leave ABC here, we talked about why would Shonda Rhimes leave ABC? Why would ABC let her go? Well, maybe she was asking for too much, or maybe Shonda Rhimes knew, hey, I can't seem to get the budgets I want anymore.
I think she was getting pretty much everything she wanted.
Okay, but
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
But you're right. The same thing is happening over at The Simpsons. They've been going for nearly 30 years now. The smash hit cartoon The Simpsons has fired its composer, Alf Clausen. They'd given him a shot, but after 27 years, decided it probably wasn't going to work out and wanted to cut their losses, for Pete's sake. In fact, losses is what this is about, since kicking Clausen to the curb after almost three decades is seen as a cost-cutting measure. Per Matt Groening's vision from the start, and he's the creator of The Simpsons, Clausen has had a 35-piece orchestra to record the full score for every episode since day one. The cost per season would reportedly run into the millions. Big deal or big whoop?
Millions. Millions. Oh, my God. That doesn't sound like a lot of money. 35 episodes, a score for every episode, a couple dozen people with jobs, and millions means what, like 7-8 million? I mean, I'm assuming that's not tens of millions, right?
I don't know. It's hard to know here, but what I would say
Yeah, if it's costing $8, $9 million a year to provide the score for all 35 original episodes of The Simpsons, that sounds like a pretty good deal for an unbelievably lucrative... That's where you're cutting back? Really?
What I would say is, okay, if you really want to do this in a mathematical, objective way, how much money is spent on the score for other like shows, whether it's animated or sitcoms? How much money is spent?
I'm sure they pay more than anybody else, and they also have one of the most successful, profitable shows of all time.
And that's where, again, I would say, start doing the math on it. and you can actually see whether it's really costing you that much more. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Has there been any blowback?
Well, people are very upset. I'm sure by and large, you won't notice it that much. You know, you got hundreds and hundreds of episodes. So the new ones, they're going to go in a different direction with more synths or who knows what they're planning to do. But they still want them involved in some way, but they're just not going to have a full orchestra. So, yeah, you know, it makes a big difference. You go to a Broadway show and the pit is, you know, 20 pieces rather than 35. That's a big difference. You don't know it. You go to a show. You don't know the difference. You don't think about it. You're like, oh, that was fun. But when you go and there's 35 people in the orchestra pit, you go, wow.
Yeah.
And that really, that is a big difference in quality. So it's a real shame. And given the massive success of the show, it seems like a bizarre way to cut back.
Yeah. I mean, certainly a 35-piece orchestra is, that's...
It's a luxury.
It's a luxury.
It's a luxury.
And
it paid off.
And it paid off, and you can really, I mean, you know the music of The Simpsons, and I don't just mean the opening credits. I mean, even the interstitial music, you know it. You know the soundtrack. It's noticeable because of the way they do it. It's kind of like, you know, Christopher Nolan with IMAX. You notice that the image looks better. Well, okay, yeah, they're taking care, and they're spending more money and time on it. Okay, mm-hmm. you get the results you pay for. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I'm guessing that this week's story really just means that we're telling you how you will be listening to music in the future. According to Goldman Sachs, you will definitely be subscribing to one of these music streaming services. At least they think so.
God knows you're not subscribing to us because we make our show available for free.
That's right, on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find our podcast.
So Goldman Sachs put out a study. It's from a team of analysts, I think led by Lisa Yang. I may not be right about that, but that's the impression I get. And they're talking about the valuation of music companies, you know, Sony Music, Universal Music, Warner Music Group, and what the future is for the music industry as a whole, and especially paid streaming subscribers. How many people are going to subscribe to streaming services? That's where all the growth is coming, and they say it's just going to get better. We're only reporting on what other people have said because we don't have access to the study ourselves because you got to pay for that.
Right. Well, and it's really meant for clients of Goldman Sachs.
Right. So what are they saying?
They're saying that by 2030, which will be easily measurable in 2030, we're all going to remember this report and hold Lisa Yang accountable for it, that there will be 850 million subscribers to music streaming services.
And where are we at right now?
I think nowhere near there. I think maybe 100 million.
We're like 120, 130 million subscribers worldwide, which means it will increase by 500% in the next 13 years.
Right. And it will increase to 34 billion. The music industry, streaming revenue will grow to 34 billion by 2030. That's more than the music industry, I think, ever made, isn't it?
That's the whole, the streaming revenue. I don't know about that. Maybe North America. I'm not sure about worldwide with touring and all that. Okay. They say the total music biz will be worth $41 billion in 2030. I'm not sure if that's North America, or I guess that's worldwide. To put that into perspective, for instance, that's going to be about an increase of 700% in revenue for streaming, in the next 13 years. According to the IFPI, annual streaming revenue grew a massive 60% in 2016, and it hit $4.5 billion. That's a huge leap. She's saying, get used to that sucker. That's going to be happening every day.
Well, I love what Music Business Worldwide said. They wrote, "You don't have to be a calculus whiz to understand just how optimistic of you this is." According to the IFP, which is the International Federation of Phonographic Institute, something like that. They're basically like the RIAA of Europe. Total recorded global streaming revenues reached $4.56 billion last year, up 60.4% on 2015. So they're saying basically, yeah, there's no way that in 15 years you're going to be reaching $34 billion.
Yeah, Variety described this as a wildly optimistic new report. Billboard said the numbers are extremely enthusiastic. Basically, everybody said, you've got to be kidding to this study. Which, will that hurt Goldman Sachs? I mean, that's what these companies do. They put out these papers. They want people to call them and say, oh, what should I be investing?
Right.
They're saying, oh, Universal Music is really undervalued. You really want to jump in on the bandwagon. But when you put out studies that are kind of basically mocked by the trade papers, I mean, that's as negative and nasty as it gets when they're winking and nudging, going wildly, you know, optimistic, extremely enthusiastic. They're saying, give me a break. That can't be good for Goldman Sachs long term, can it?
Well, I always take this with a grain of salt. I kind of wonder if anybody ever remembers
but they remember that the study came out and it was mocked by Variety and Billboard today. And they're saying that's stupid. We don't know what their explanation is for why they believe there'll be such massive growth. And if you look at penetration and what's happening in other areas, hey, people subscribe to TV, don't they? Worldwide, about 1 billion households have some sort of TV subscription, whether that includes just Netflix or is only like cable providers and satellite and whatever, it's unclear. But there are 1 billion households that subscribe to TV, and that's more expensive than a streaming music service. And of course, that means with a couple of 130 million people doing it now, there's a lot of room for growth in the music streaming service. There is, but that faster growth that quickly, other than saying, hey, look, it's cheap, it's easy, every phone can get access to it, all you do is pay $10 a month, maybe they're saying, hey, it's so easy to do, people will just do it.
Well, I think you and I both agree. It seems unbelievable that it would grow to those levels. But then look at concert tickets. We never thought we would be paying the prices we're paying for concert tickets.
Well, that's prices. That's not quite the number of people going to a concert would be the thing you'd want to compare to. But you're trying to segue into Taylor Swift, who's got, of course, a new album coming out. She's got a new concert ticket scheme. And like seemingly everybody, like Bruce Springsteen, she's using Ticketmaster's verified fan system.
Yeah. Now, this is a way that these artists are trying to kind of get tickets into the hands of legitimate fans as opposed to into the hands of bots or into the hands of scalpers. So they're kind of going and they're trying to say, okay, Michael Gilt's registered as a verified fan of Taylor Swift. Is this person really a verified fan? Who are they? Are they an actual person? Oh, they have a Facebook profile and it looks like they've had this profile on Facebook and Twitter for a while now. And look, there's pictures of them all over the place here. And oh, they do go to music events. So they do seem to be, a real human being that's a fan of this type of music. So that's what verified fan does, as opposed to, gee, here's a Facebook page or Facebook account that was created 4 days ago, has no pictures on it. We have no idea whether this person is actually a human being or not.
Well, right. But basically, they're just saying, we're not going to let bots try and buy tickets. And it's really hard to stop. So they've come up with this little elaborate system where you have to register in advance and say, I'm a real person. They check. You are. You've got credit cards. You've got a phone. There's a million ways to check quickly that you're a real person rather than a bot. And they say, okay, you're a real person. So you get to go into the lottery to try and buy tickets if we give you access. So it's good. And it worked.
And
it worked on Springsteen.
It worked on Springsteen, which we will tell you about in a moment.
Yeah.
But here's what I love about Taylor Swift, and this is, I kind of have to say, now I know the meaning of her new song, Look What You Made Me Do, okay? It's really what fans will be saying to her, okay? Because to get into this line, okay, so you have to be selected as a verified fan, then you're put in line and in a lottery. So first, verified fan, you get picked in the lottery, then you get put in line. To move up in line, you pre-order the CD, okay, so, and what I love is that Hypebot says, yes, she's still trying to squeeze the last drop out of that format, and you can buy it either from, a big box retailer or her own website, and you can buy it as many as 13 times, okay, and so that moves you up each one of those times, and if you get it expedited, because she has a sponsorship with UPS, if you have it delivered expedited so you get it on the day of the album release, it will cost you $63 for a CD. But that will move you up even further. Or what are some of the other things? You can watch the video 5 times a day to move up in line, and basically all this promotional stuff and all this ancillary sales stuff to move up in line. And it's just kind of like, what? I mean, it's. I could see fans getting a little perturbed at that.
Right. Well, she says basically, look, I'm just rewarding people for doing what they're already doing. They're already watching the video a lot. And I'm just saying, if you do, you're proving yourself a super fan. You get to move up in line. She's not trying to make you watch the video. She's just saying, if you do, you're going to get rewarded for it. The CD thing is out of whack and stupid, and they won't do that again. That was a mistake. Why would you want someone to buy 13 copies of it? Paying $50 to have it same day is ridiculous. You can get the book same day. It comes out automatically. You know, they can just ship it to you so it arrives that day. So that's all a mistake. They won't do that again, I don't think. But the other stuff, she's saying, hey, I'm not trying to force people to, I'm like, you're doing it already, and I'm going to reward you. So, you know, you got to adjust every time.
So what she's saying, so she's, look at what I made you do that you're doing already.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing it already. Relax, you know. You don't have to watch the videos 10 times in order to get buy tickets, but it helps.
Right. Now, okay, so does Verified Fan work? Michael, you and I used Verified Fan. Okay.
And we talked about it last week, right?
We've talked about it in the episodes leading up to this one. And we both signed up for Springsteen on Broadway. And sure enough, I get selected for Springsteen on Broadway. And if I checked my email, I would have known with 8 hours warning or, you know, 9 hours warning that I had been selected.
And I was on standby.
And so I was selected and I got a text with, you know, maybe 20 minutes notice. Hey, here's your code. Okay, the on sale starts in like half an hour. And by the way, it was also added to my calendar by Ticketmaster. That was kind of cool and yet really scary because it was added to my Google calendar. And I had this code. And you and I were on the phone together when we did this. The on sale started. I picked a random date. I figured middle of the week is probably better than a weekend to get tickets because I had no idea how many of these codes were given out. I figured there's 40,000 tickets for sale. It's an 8-week run. I just picked a random day, Tuesday, October 17th. And I asked you, I said, well, should I go for the $5 to $850 tickets, which we'll get to in a moment, or the $75 to $500 tickets? And you said, Michael?
I said, buy the bigger ones. Even if you can't use it, you know you can sell it.
Right. And so we selected the expensive ones. I put in the code. And after about 5 minutes of waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, don't refresh. Don't refresh your browser. Don't open another tab. You will lose your place in line. Finally, they said, okay, here's your tickets. They cost $750. They're in row 10, two seats off the aisle.
No, they were $500.
No, $750.
I thought you bought the $500 ones and the $750 were in the center. You said the $750 must be in the center of the orchestra.
$850 are in the center.
I thought they were $500.
No, $750.
Dear God.
Yes. $750.
I thought they were $500. I can't believe I misunderstood you that much.
Well, in any case, they're $750 a ticket. Can you believe that?
Wow. No.
And that's...
I thought $500 was bad. Now I really don't know what to think.
Now I will actually press play on the Michael rant.
Well, you know, the good thing is that they frustrated the bots and real people were able to get access. Everybody I know... like 10 people applied. You and my friend Noam are the only two who got access. So real people got access. Most people didn't because millions of people signed up and there's only, you know, 40,000 tickets. And I'm sure 10,000 of them or 12,000 were gone already for, you know, needs for press and superstars and all that sort of thing. So you got access and you were able to go online and buy a ticket. It took you a while. You were afraid to search around because it took so long for the browser to just show tickets available. You just bought them. My friend Noam went online and he tried to buy cheap tickets. And you know what? He was a standby person. It was an hour after it began where they said, hey, you can now try to get tickets. So that worked. He went online, tried to buy tickets. Every date he picked, no $75 tickets. But we got $450 tickets. We got much more expensive tickets. Every single date he went to, he could not find. So they sold out immediately of the cheap tickets. And the higher price tickets sold out eventually, but clearly people didn't want them. They wanted to buy the cheaper tickets. So to me, that says, yeah, it worked. Yeah, you can get people to pay any price you want. But, you know, since this isn't about the money, why are you charging $750 and $850 for these tickets? You know, he could sell at a stadium in a minute. You're on Broadway. Why are you charging? If you're trying to frustrate scalpers, that should mean you don't have to charge that much money. They're not going to get it. And of course, they're online now for $7,000 already. But if you would just say, people, bring your ID, bring your credit card. When you walk in the door, you're going to have to show your ID and show us your tickets. That would be it. There'd be no scalping.
Yeah, and that's what Bruce Springsteen did when he played his 1999 tour at the Staples Center here in Los Angeles. The first night was a little rough, you know, to get 18,000 people through the door where literally you would show the credit card you used to purchase the tickets, and then you were given a wristband. You were not allowed. There was no ticket, and you were not allowed out of the venue.
Right. Well, like usual, you go into a venue, you don't leave,
right.
You know.
But you couldn't, like, get the ticket at will call, turn around, and sell it to somebody out on the street. So,
right. No, exactly.
So, you know, you were pretty much already inside the venue when you were given the wristband. That was it. You were in.
Yeah. And if they, so they fought the bots and they won, but they didn't bother fighting the scalpers and they're charging obscene prices. Bruce Springsteen, it's really disappointing. It's really actually, I had sort of wrapped my head around $500, but $750. Now I'm reeling. Now I'm like, what the hell? You know, you can sell them for face value. You know, you don't have to be a scalper. You know, you can sell them, Sperling. There are people who will be happy to buy them, but that's just ridiculous. You know, that's a month's rent.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if, because we all knew, and I know this is probably going on too long for some people, but we all knew that artists gave tickets to the secondary market. So the Taylor Swifts of the world, knowing that they could get, you know, $2,000 on the open on the secondary market, would just give them to the secondary market and take a cut of that. That way they didn't seem like, you know, the greedy people. It's the secondary market that's doing it, not me. It's the concert promoter doing it, not me. Now this is direct. This is actually Bruce Springsteen on Broadway. And yes, maybe it's only because it's on Broadway that he's actually, and his manager is actually saying, no, we're going to make it so that it's less profitable for the scalpers. Even if they get in, it will be less profitable because the ticket price is so high already.
But it's not, because they're asking people will pay $5,000 for a ticket. People who don't care about the money will pay it. The point is not what can you charge, but what should you charge?
Right. Yeah.
Hamilton should not be charging $900 for a ticket to see Hamilton on Broadway.
Especially now, since the entire original cast is gone.
Yeah, yeah. They can get it.
I mean,
that's right.
The reality is, in 20 years, Michael, this won't matter to you or I, not only because Bruce Springsteen probably won't be playing anymore, okay, but because we won't know any of the people who are doing things like this anyway, even at any price, because we won't know what songs and what musicians are playing.
Speak for yourself. You put up a list from Spotify of the most streamed songs of the summer for the U.S. They also have one for worldwide. It's like Daddy Yankee and Despacito, of course, DJ Khalid, French Montana, Kendrick Lamar, 21 Savage, Khalid, who's got a great new album, a debut album, Childish Gambino, Calvin Harris, Liam Payne from One Direction, Imagine Dragons, Kendrick Lamar, Charlie Puth, Sam Hunt. I mean, I know all these people.
Okay, actually, when you started listing them, you're right. I do. Logic, I don't know. Okay.
A little Uzi Vert. I'm not sure who that is. Post Malone, I don't know who that is. Maybe I'd recognize the song if I played
Playboy
it.
Playboy Carti. Yeah. I mean, I have no idea who Playboy Carti is.
Right. But most of them, you recognize. And my God, Justin Bieber is all over this.
He's on the same thing. I said, Justin Bieber is like the guest musician or guest singer on half these songs.
Yeah. Smart guy.
Unlike myself, who just paid $1,400 for two Bruce Springsteen tickets.
I thought they were $500. And you know, Noam had access to tickets at the front row mezzanine for $450. And he just couldn't bring himself to pay it. He's like, I just won't pay that much money. You know, it's just too much money. Good God, I wish we'd had those. Those are better seats than what we bought and for $300 less per ticket.
Yeah, I mean.
And you couldn't search around because you were so freaked out because it took forever for the browser. An hour later, you could have bought tickets front row mezzanine if you'd found the right date for $450. So the fact that they were a little overwhelmed by people, but clearly by the way tickets sold, people went for the cheap tickets first. That's not what usually happens. What usually happens is the best seats go first, but that's because they charge too damn much money. It's really a shame.
I would really love to be a fly on the wall of the room where they decided how to price these tickets. I'd love to know the reasoning behind it.
Well, they can make more money.
True. Besides that, though.
What else reason is there? They probably kidded themselves that they would, you know, frustrate the scalpers by charging a big premium price right off the bat. So scalpers, well, it doesn't work. There's always going to be some schmuck who'll pay $10,000 so they can go, Bruce!
Will they do that on Broadway?
We're hoping not. But, you know, we shall see. But they also yelled Steely Dan back in the day, didn't they?
Well, I don't know if they did that. I've got to be honest. I never went to a Steely Dan concert.
Well, you won't ever again. But actually, that's not true. Walter Becker, one half of this duo known as Steely Dan, died at 67. He had an illness. We knew he wasn't well. He'd missed some concerts. Donald Fagen, who's the other half of Steely Dan, reported that he'd had surgery for an issue and that they all hoped it would get better. But clearly that didn't happen. He died at 67, which sure sounds young to me. And The Usual Praises came out for Steely Dan, a classic group from the 70s and early 80s, who then sprang back to life in 2000 and won the Grammy for Album of the Year, which was really a career award. But fun memories of Walter Becker, and Donald Fagen did have, you know, a really nice message that he put out, you know, acknowledging that they'd been fought and, you know, separated for a number of years and weren't speaking to each other, but got back together and had an enduring lifelong friendship, and saying, hey, you know, we're going to miss him, and I'm going to try to keep our music alive for as long as I can. So he clearly says, yeah, I'm going to keep touring as Steely Dan or whatever. But, you know, Walter Becker's irreplaceable.
Did he say yes? And I'm playing at the Canyon Club on Thursday. Come down and see me.
No, it was really sweet. You can find it all over the place online. The full message, the full reminiscence he put out about his life and relationship with Walter Becker. They knew themselves from college days, had a great career. It's funny. I've just been talking about, you know, people do binge watching of TV shows and movies. And I've been saying we should be doing binge music listening. And I want to do that to bring back the album and bring back listening to an artist, how that makes a difference. You know, just like when you watch a TV show all at once, the whole series, it has a different impact. And you can sort of see the strengths and weaknesses in a new way that you can't when you watch it over a period of 3 or 5 years. The same thing can happen when you binge listen and you say, all right, I want to listen to Steely Dan. I'm going to listen to all their albums, all 8, 10 albums in a row, you know, one a day for the next 2 weeks. And so I've been thinking about doing that and getting ready to do that. And they were going to be my first act, and Billy Joel will be the second, and Joni Mitchell will be the third. And I just haven't pulled the trigger on it. And now he's dead. I don't know whether it feels like, you know, trying to take advantage of that or what, but I've been thinking about it for a while and I wanted to do it. Now I'm not sure what to do.
Okay. Well, I do know one thing that our listeners should do.
What's that?
They should subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. If you haven't subscribed, rated, and reviewed the show already in those podcast aggregators, please do. It does help us out when you do. In fact, tell friends that you think would be interested in the show about the shows that they subscribe. That would really help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle there. Or Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our Facebook page can be liked, and we do respond to messages and posts to either Twitter or Facebook, so you can reach out there. All of that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Bruce, you charge too much damn money.com.
That's an appropriate domain for this week. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to thehuffingtonpost.com, or you can also visit michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, do not forget to check out bookfilter.com to find out what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.